The spirit of liberty went with the Bible. Wherever the gospel was received, the minds of the people were awakened. They began to cast off the shackles that had held them bond slaves of ignorance, vice, and superstition. They began to think and act as men. Monarchs saw it and trembled for their despotism. Rome was not slow to inflame their jealous fears. Said the Pope to the Regent of France in 1525, "This mania, Protestantism, will not only confound and destroy religion, but all principalities, nobility, laws, orders, and ranks besides." From G. de Falis, History of the Protestants of France, Book 1, Chapter 2, Paragraph 8. A few years later, a papal nuncio warned the king, "Sire, be not deceived. The Protestants will upset all civil as well as religious order. The throne is in as much danger as the altar. The introduction of a new religion must necessarily introduce a new government." From D'Aubigné's History of the Reformation in Europe in the Time of Calvin, Book 2, Chapter 36. And theologians appeal to the prejudices of the people by declaring that the Protestant doctrine entices men away to novelties and folly. It robs the king of the devoted affection of his subjects and devastates both church and state. Thus Rome succeeded in arraying France against the Reformation. It was to uphold the throne, preserve the nobles, and maintain the laws that the sword of persecution was first unsheathed in France. Quoted from Wiley's Book 13, Chapter 4. Little did the rulers of the land foresee the results of that fateful policy. The teaching of the Bible would have implanted in the minds and hearts of the people those principles of justice, temperance, truth, equity, and benevolence, which are the very cornerstone of a nation's prosperity. Righteousness exalteth a nation. Thereby the throne is established. Proverbs 14:34 and 16:12. The work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect, quietness and assurance forever. Isaiah 32:17. He who obeys the divine law will most truly respect and obey the laws of his country. He who fears God will honor the king in the exercise of all just and legitimate authority. But unhappy France prohibited the Bible and banned its disciples. Century after century, men of principle and integrity, men of intellectual acuteness and moral strength, who had the courage to avow their convictions and the faith to suffer for the truth, for centuries these men toiled as slaves in the galleys, perished at the stake, or rotted in dungeon cells. Thousands upon thousands found safety in flight, and this continued for 250 years after the opening of the Reformation. Scarcely was there a generation of Frenchmen during that long period that did not witness the disciples of the gospel fleeing before the insane fury of the persecutor, and carrying with them the intelligence, the arts, the industry, the order, in which as a rule they preeminently excelled, to enrich the lands in which they found an asylum. And in proportion as they replenished other countries with these good gifts, did they empty their own of them. If all that was now driven away had been retained in France, if during these 300 years the industrial skill of the exiles had been cultivating her soil, if during these 300 years their artistic bent had been improving her manufactures, if during these 300 years their creative genius and analytical power had been enriching her literature and cultivating her science, if their wisdom had been guiding her counsels, their bravery fighting her battles, their equity framing her laws, and the religion of the Bible strengthening the intellect and governing the conscience of her people, what a glory would at this day have encompassed France! What a great, prosperous, and happy country, a pattern to the nations, would she have been! But a blind and inexorable bigotry chased from her soil every teacher of virtue, every champion of order, every honest defender of the throne. It said to the men who would have made their country a renown and glory in the earth, "Choose which you will have, a stake or exile." At last the ruin of the state was complete. There remained no more conscience to be proscribed, no more religion to be dragged to the stake, no more patriotism to be chased into banishment. From Wiley's Book 13, Chapter 20, and the Revolution, with all its horrors, was the dire result. With the flight of the Huguenots, a general decline settled upon France. Flourishing manufacturing cities fell into decay. Fertile districts returned to their native wildness. Intellectual dullness and moral declension succeeded a period of unwanted progress. Paris became one vast almshouse, and it is estimated that, at the breaking out of the Revolution, 200,000 paupers claimed charity from the hands of the king. The Jesuits alone flourished in the decaying nation and ruled with dreadful tyranny over churches and schools, the prisons, and the galleys. The gospel would have brought to France the solution of those political and social problems that baffled the skill of her clergy, her king, and her legislators, and finally plunged the nation into anarchy and ruin. But under the domination of Rome, the people had lost the Savior's blessed lessons of self-sacrifice and unselfish love. They had been led away from the practice of self-denial for the good of others. The rich had found no rebuke for their oppression of the poor, the poor no help for their servitude and degradation. The selfishness of the wealthy and powerful grew more and more apparent and oppressive. For centuries, the greed and profligacy of the noble resulted in grinding extortion toward the peasant. The rich wronged the poor, and the poor hated the rich. In many provinces, the estates were held by the nobles, and the laboring classes were only tenants. They were at the mercy of their landlords and were forced to submit to their exorbitant demands. The burden of supporting both the church and the state fell upon the middle and lower classes, who were heavily taxed by the civil authorities and by the clergy. The pleasure of the nobles was considered the supreme law. The farmers and the peasants might starve for aught their oppressors cared. The people were compelled at every turn to consult the exclusive interests of the landlord. The lives of the agricultural laborers were lives of incessant work and unrelieved misery. Their complaints, if they ever dared to complain, were treated with insolent contempt. The courts of justice would always listen to a noble as against a peasant. Bribes were notoriously accepted by the judges, and the merest caprice of the aristocracy had the force of law by virtue of this system of universal corruption. Of the taxes wrung from the commonalty, by the secular magnates on the one hand and the clergy on the other, not half ever found its way into the royal or episcopal treasury. The rest was squandered in profligate self-indulgence. And the men who thus impoverished their fellow subjects were themselves exempt from taxation and entitled by law or custom to all the appointments of the state. The privileged classes numbered 150,000, and for their gratification, millions were condemned to hopeless and degrading lives. The court was given up to luxury and profligacy. There was little confidence existing between the people and the rulers. Suspicion fastened upon all the measures of the government as designing and selfish. For more than half a century before the time of the Revolution, the throne was occupied by Louis XV, who, even in those evil times, was distinguished as an indolent, frivolous, and sensual monarch. With a depraved and cruel aristocracy and an impoverished and ignorant lower class, the state financially embarrassed and the people exasperated, it needed no prophet's eye to foresee a terrible impending outbreak. To the warnings of his counselors, the king was accustomed to reply, "Try to make things go on as long as I am likely to live. After my death, it may be as it will." It was in vain that the necessity of reform was urged. He saw the evils, but had neither the courage nor the power to meet them. The doom awaiting France was but too truly pictured in his indolent and selfish answer, "After me, the deluge." By working upon the jealousy of the kings and the ruling classes, Rome had influenced them to keep the people in bondage, well knowing that the state would thus be weakened, and purposing by this means to fasten both rulers and people in her thrall. With far-sighted policy, she perceived that in order to enslave men effectually, the shackles must be bound upon their souls, that the surest way to prevent them from escaping their bondage was to render them incapable of freedom. A thousandfold more terrible than the physical suffering which resulted from her policy was the moral degradation. Deprived of the Bible and abandoned to the teachings of bigotry and selfishness, the people were shrouded in ignorance and superstition and sunken in vice, so that they were wholly unfitted for self-government. But the outworking of all this was widely different from what Rome had purposed. Instead of holding the masses in a blind submission to her dogmas, her work resulted in making them infidels and revolutionists. Romanism they despised as priestcraft. They beheld the clergy as a party to their oppression. The only God they knew was the God of Rome. Her teaching was their only religion. They regarded her greed and cruelty as the legitimate fruit of the Bible, and they would have none of it. Rome had misrepresented the character of God and perverted his requirements, and now men rejected both the Bible and its author. She had required a blind faith in her dogmas under the pretended sanction of the Scriptures. In the reaction, Voltaire and his associates cast aside God's word altogether and spread everywhere the poison of infidelity. Rome had ground down the people under her iron heel, and now the masses, degraded and brutalized in their recoil from her tyranny, cast off all restraint. Enraged at the glittering cheat to which they had so long paid homage, they rejected truth and falsehood together. And mistaking license for liberty, the slaves of vice exulted in their imagined freedom. At the opening of the revolution, by a concession of the king, the people were granted a representation exceeding that of the nobles and clergy combined. Thus the balance of power was in their hands, but they were not prepared to use it with wisdom and moderation. Eager to redress the wrongs they had suffered, they determined to undertake the reconstruction of society. An outraged populace, whose minds were filled with bitter and long-treasured memories of wrong, resolved to revolutionize the state of misery that had grown unbearable and to revenge themselves upon those whom they regarded as the authors of their sufferings. The oppressed wrought out the lesson they had learned under tyranny and became the oppressors of those who had oppressed them. Unhappy France reaped in blood the harvest she had sown. Terrible were the results of her submission to the controlling power of Rome. Where France, under the influence of Romanism, had set up the first stake at the opening of the Reformation, there the Revolution set up its first guillotine. On the very spot where the first martyrs to the Protestant faith were burned in the 16th century, the first victims were guillotined in the 18th. In repelling the gospel, which would have brought her healing, France had opened the door to infidelity and ruin. When the restraints of God's law were cast aside, it was found that the laws of man were inadequate to hold in check the powerful tides of human passion, and the nation swept on to revolt and anarchy. The war against the Bible inaugurated an era which stands in the world's history as the Reign of Terror. Peace and happiness were banished from the homes and hearts of men. No one was secure. He who triumphed today was suspected, condemned tomorrow. Violence and lust held undisputed sway. King, clergy, and nobles were compelled to submit to the atrocities of an excited and maddened people. Their thirst for vengeance was only stimulated by the execution of the king, and those who had decreed his death soon followed him to the scaffold. A general slaughter of all suspected of hostility to the revolution was determined. The prisons were crowded, at one time containing more than 200,000 captives. The cities of the kingdom were filled with scenes of horror. One party of revolutionists was against another party, and France became a vast field for contending masses, swayed by the fury of their passions. In Paris, one tumult succeeded another, and the citizens were divided into a medley of factions that seemed intent on nothing but mutual extermination. And to add to the general misery, the nation became involved in a prolonged and devastating war with the great powers of Europe. The country was nearly bankrupt. The armies were clamoring for arrears of pay. The Parisians were starving. The provinces were laid waste by brigands, and civilization was almost extinguished in anarchy and license. All too well, the people had learned the lessons of cruelty and torture which Rome had so diligently taught. A day of retribution at last had come. It was not now the disciples of Jesus that were thrust into dungeons and dragged to the stake. Long ago, these had perished or been driven into exile. Unsparing Rome now felt the deadly power of those whom she had trained to delight in deeds of blood. the example of persecution which the clergy of France had exhibited for so many ages was now reported upon them with signal vigor. The scaffolds ran red with the blood of the priests. The galleys and the prisons, once crowded with Huguenots, were now filled with their persecutors. Chained to the bench and toiling at the oar, the Roman Catholic clergy experienced all those woes which their church had so freely inflicted on the gentle heretics. Then came those days when the most barbarous of all codes was administered by the most barbarous of all tribunals, when no man could greet his neighbor or say his prayers without danger of committing a capital crime, when spies lurked in every corner, when the guillotine was long and hard at work every morning, when the jails were filled as close as the holds of a slave ship, when the gutters ran foaming with blood into the Seine, while the daily wagon loads of victims were carried to their doom through the streets of Paris, the proconsuls, whom the Sovereign Committee had sent forth to the departments, reveled in an extravagance of cruelty unknown even in the capital. The knife of the deadly machine rose and fell too slow for their work of slaughter. Long rows of captives were mowed down with grape shot. Holes were made in the bottom of crowded barges. Lyons was turned into a desert. At Arras, even the cruel mercy of a speedy death was denied to the prisoners. All down the Loire, from Sommer to the sea, great flocks of crows and kites feasted on naked corpses, twined together in hideous embraces. No mercy was shown to sex or age. The number of young lads and of girls of 17 who were murdered by that execrable government is to be reckoned by hundreds. Babies torn from the breast were tossed from pike to pike along the Jacobin ranks. In the short space of 10 years, multitudes of human beings perished. All this was as Satan would have it. This was what for ages he had been working to secure. His policy is deception from first to last, and his steadfast purpose is to bring woe and wretchedness upon men, to deface and defile the workmanship of God, to mar the divine purposes of benevolence and love, and thus cause grief in heaven. Then, by his deceptive arts, he blinds the minds of men and leads them to throw back the blame of his work upon God, as if all this misery were the result of the Creator's plan. In like manner, when those who have been degraded and brutalized through his cruel power achieve their freedom, he urges them on to excesses and atrocities. Then this picture of unbridled license is pointed out by tyrants and oppressors as an illustration of the results of liberty. When error in one garb has been detected, Satan only masks it in a different disguise, and multitudes receive it as eagerly as at the first. When the people found Romanism to be a deception, and he could not through this agency lead them to transgression of God's law, he urged them to regard all religion as a cheat, and the Bible as a fable, and casting aside the divine statutes, they gave themselves up to unbridled iniquity. The fatal error which wrought such woe for the inhabitants of France was the ignoring of this one great truth, that true freedom lies within the proscriptions of the law of God. Oh, that thou hadst hearkened to my commandments! Then had thy peace been as a river, and thy righteousness as the waves of the sea. There is no peace, saith the Lord, unto the wicked, but whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely, and shall be quiet from fear of evil. Isaiah 48, verses 18 and 22, and Proverbs chapter 1, verse 33. Atheists, infidels, and apostates oppose and denounce God's law, but the results of their influence prove that the well-being of man is bound up with his obedience of the divine statutes. Those who will not read the lesson from the book of God are bidden to read it in the history of nations. When Satan wrought through the Roman Church to lead men away from obedience, his agency was concealed, and his work was so disguised that the degradation and misery which resulted were not seen to be the fruit of transgression. And his power was so far counteracted by the working of the Spirit of God that his purposes were prevented from reaching their full fruition. The people did not trace the effect to its cause and discover the source of their miseries. but in the Revolution, the law of God was openly set aside by the National Council. And in the reign of terror which followed, the working of cause and effect could be seen by all. When France publicly rejected God and set aside the Bible, wicked men and spirits of darkness exulted in their attainment of the object so long desired, a kingdom free from the restraints of the law of God. Because sentence against an evil work was not speedily executed, therefore the heart of the sons of men was fully set in them to do evil. Ecclesiastes 8:11. But the transgression of a just and righteous law must inevitably result in misery and ruin. Though not visited at once with judgments, the wickedness of men was nevertheless surely working out their doom. Centuries of apostasy and crime had been treasuring up wrath against the day of retribution, and when their iniquity was full, the despisers of God learned too late that it is a fearful thing to have worn out the divine patience. The restraining spirit of God, which imposes a check upon the cruel power of Satan, was in a great measure removed, and he whose only delight is the wretchedness of men was permitted to work his will. Those who had chosen the service of rebellion were left to reap its fruits until the land was filled with crimes too horrible for pen to trace. From devastated provinces and ruined cities, a terrible cry was heard, a cry of bitterest anguish. France was shaken as if by an earthquake. Religion, law, social order, the family, the state, and the church, all were smitten down by the impious hand that had been lifted against the law of God. Truly, spoke the wise man, the wicked shall fall by his own wickedness. Though a sinner do evil 100 times and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him, but it shall not be well with the wicked. Proverbs 11:5 and Ecclesiastes 8, verses 12 and 13. They hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices. Proverbs chapter 1, verses 29 and 31. God's faithful witnesses, slain by the blasphemous power that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit, were not long to remain silent. After 3 days and a half, the spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them which saw them. Revelation 11:11. It was in 1793 that the decrees which abolished the Christian religion and set aside the Bible passed the French Assembly. 3 years and a half later, a resolution rescinding these decrees, thus granting toleration to the Scriptures, was adopted by the same body. The world stood aghast at the enormity of guilt which had resulted from a rejection of the sacred oracles, and men recognized the necessity of faith in God and His Word as the foundation of virtue and morality. Saith the Lord, Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high, even against the Holy One of Israel? Isaiah 37:23. Therefore, behold, I will cause them to know, this once will I cause them to know, my hand and my might, and they shall know that my name is Jehovah. Jeremiah 16:21, in the American Revised Version. Concerning the two witnesses, the prophet declares further, And they heard a great voice from heaven, saying unto them, Come up hither. And they ascended up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them. Revelation 11:12. Since France made war upon God's two witnesses, they have been honored as never before. In 1804, the British and Foreign Bible Society was organized. This was followed by similar organizations with numerous branches upon the continent of Europe. In 1816, the American Bible Society was founded. When the British Society was formed, the Bible had been printed and circulated in 50 tongues. It has since been translated into many hundreds of languages and dialects. For the 50 years preceding 1792, little attention was given to the work of foreign missions. No new societies were formed, and there were but few churches that made any effort for the spread of Christianity in heathen lands. But toward the close of the 18th century, a great change took place. Men became dissatisfied with the results of rationalism and realized the necessity of divine revelation and experimental religion. From this time, the work of foreign missions attained an unprecedented growth. The improvements in printing have given an impetus to the work of circulating the Bible. The increased facilities for communication between different countries, the breaking down of ancient barriers of prejudice and national exclusiveness, and the loss of secular power by the Pontiff of Rome have opened the way for the entrance of the Word of God. For some years, the Bible has been sold without restraints in the streets of Rome, and it has now been carried to every part of the habitable globe. The infidel Voltaire once boastingly said, "I am weary of hearing people repeat that 12 men established the Christian religion. I will prove that one man may suffice to overthrow it." Generations have passed since his death. Millions have joined in the war upon the Bible. But it is so far from being destroyed that where there were 100 in Voltaire's time, there are now 10,000, yes, 100,000 copies of the Book of God. In the words of an early reformer concerning the Christian church, the Bible is an anvil that has worn out many hammers. Saith the Lord, "No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn." Isaiah 54:17. The word of our God shall stand forever. All his commandments are sure. They stand fast forever and ever, and are done in truth and uprightness. Isaiah 40:8 and Psalm 111:7-8. Whatever is built upon the authority of man will be overthrown, but that which is founded upon the rock of God's immutable word shall stand forever.